it doesn't matter how long the time goes on, that it can still tear your own heart apart. And one of the biggest things I've learned through this is it doesn't just affect that child, it affects the entire family.
Welcome to the Jess Nahu podcast, where we delve into the heart of extraordinary stories, resilience, adversity, advocacy, special needs, birth trauma, and so much more. I'm your host, Jess Nahu.
Hello, everyone. How are you? Welcome to another episode of the Jess Nahu podcast. And today we are doing another bit of storytelling about Hawaiki's entrance to this world. So on our last episode that we recorded about this, I think I had ended where he had been put into his second induced coma. We were then transferred to the Queensland Children's Hospital in South Brisbane, and he was actually intubated in the coma whilst we were transferred and we had arrived at the hospital. And then also about how the person that was looking after us in ICU was telling me how it doesn't take scientists to figure out what's going on with this child. And there were so many things being discussed. So following on from that, I remember the family and everyone arriving the very next morning. And I just remember them wanting to do more scans. So I think he was set for, he'd done another MRI and just see if there was any difference in the previous, I think, two or three MRIs he had done on his brain. And all of his info was starting to come back. And so he was in the coma, I think, for maybe 36 hours again, and then he was brought out. Once he was stabilised, then we were moved to the ward, and it was in the baby ward at the Queensland Children's Hospital. But we were put into a line of sight room. So in this line of sight room, you have just curtains blocked off, but you had three beds, and there were babies that had just come out of ICU but needed still intense care, so that you were able to be seen by the nurses in this room. And in that room, I remember this beautiful mum, Anna, and her daughter, Zara Rose, and they were there. They'd been there for quite a while, and Zara, I think, is maybe 4 to 6 months older than Hawaiki. And there was a couple of people that had been in and out of the other bed, but there was, the last one I remember was a mum of a little boy who had a lot going on as well. So during this day, they were doing a lot of testing. They just honestly didn't know what was going on with him. He had stopped breathing again. And so they were really testing, I think, everything they possibly could just to try and get the data and laying the foundations of what was going on. So he'd had, you know, numerous MRIs, CT scans, x-rays on body, measuring everything. And there came a time where they ran a family meeting. And this was the first one that we'd had. And I didn't really know what to expect because my husband was at work. It was just me. But I remember one of the nurses came up, she said, we're going to organise a support worker to be with you because you're going to need it. And I was thinking, what happens in these? What happens in these family meetings? So I remember that all being organised, and we'd gone in and we'd set the time, and I walked into the room and hoping, you know, I'm going to get all this information, we're going to know what's going on. But there was all these different specialist teams. And I just remember walking in, looking around, and just my head dropping, then looking up and said, why are there so many of you? What is going on with my son? And that was a really hard moment, because you want to, you know, start believing that there's all this, you know, they're finding out what's wrong, they're just going to deal with it and it's all going to be okay. But when you see all these different teams, you just become gobsmacked. So I sat down and I had social worker next to me, who I'd only just met previously, like I didn't even know her. And all of them started telling them stuff that they had found. And the biggest thing that stood out was that on the last brain MRI, they had found this white matter that had appeared on his brain, and they didn't know what it was. And that the myelination in the brain stem hadn't grown to where it should be. And I remember looking at them and saying, okay, so what do we do now? And they looked at me and said, nothing, just let him be a baby. And it was almost like, well, pretty much was, that they're just saying, there's nothing we can do, just let him be a child. And I'm like, what? He's been through so much already. Like, he's had seizures, he's been dropped on his head, he has so much going on. He had been already intubated 2 times, put into a coma 2 times, and he was 6 weeks old by this stage. And I'm like, just let him be a baby. I'm like, I can't just, you know, sit here and do nothing. And I'll do in another episode the following of stuff that I did to help him at home because of my background of being in massage and also physical, like a PT, personal trainer, fitness, exercise, and knowing how this can help. And I just couldn't believe, like, they're just like nothing. Then they were also throwing out, we think he's got a degenerative disease. It was, I can't remember the name of it. But I was just like, where they actually thought what was happening was his brain was growing, but then it was being broken down by this degenerative disease. And that, I didn't believe it, but when you're in a hospital with your baby who's only 6 weeks old, and you've got all these specialists trying to figure out what's going on with him whilst you're trying to save him, because by this stage, this is the third time that we've nearly lost him at 6 weeks old. It is very overwhelming. And as much as family want to be there for you, I think you go through this phase of not having the energy to be around anyone because you're just trying to deal with all of this information overload. And I remember one of my cousins, she's so beautiful. She's like, you know what, I can come and see you. And I didn't want to see anyone. Like, I was just trying to survive. So I remember walking back out of that meeting, and so I'd also made one of the nurses stay with Hawaii and not leave him whilst I was in there because I couldn't take him in. He was attached to machines and all this stuff. So my husband was at work, and yeah, so one of the nurses was there, and so she could go when I got back. And we also had this beautiful nurse navigator where she looked after families that were in the hospital system, organising all information and all your appointments together as much as you can, especially when you've got a child with such high complex medical needs like Hawaii. And she came to me and she just said, I know that you're one of the mums that wants to know everything. And so she had printed out all these documents for me about everything that was discussed in the meeting, particularly the degenerative disease of what could possibly be happening. And, you know, I'm reading over it and looking at the life expectancy of these kids that have it. And it's really hard to explain how in that moment you actually start envisioning what your life might be like and what might happen if you lose your baby. Because no one knew what was going on with him. And so that night I remember just cuddling him so much, but reading all the information that I can, so then I start, you know, going down the rabbit hole of looking up all these information that's been thrown at you, all these, you know, diseases and things that could be happening with your child, and trying to understand it all because you don't really know what's going on. And at the same time, all you want to do is crawl under a rock and pray that this nightmare will be over soon. And I remember that night, he woke, and, you know, as the babies do, to be fed, and he was wide awake, and I was breastfeeding him, and as I was feeding him, I was singing to him, because it was one of the things that I did from when he was born, and first in NICU, and one of the nurses that was looking after him, she said to me, whenever he's awake, you sing to him, you read to him, you stimulate his brain, because that's what he needs right now. And so that's what I did. Even when I was in that line of sight room, and there's other parents staying, and I know that I could possibly wake someone up, I was trying to keep quiet. But for me, all I needed to concentrate on was my baby and to stimulate his brain. And so that's what I did. So whether it was 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., whatever it was, in the middle of the night, I would sing to him and stimulate his brain. So during that stay, I also remember throughout the testing, and there was one day they were coming in to test his heart, and they come in and they do the testing, and then she said to me, his heart's okay. And they're going around the room, you know, the next baby, and her heart's okay. And then the next little boy, they tested his heart, and then they closed the curtains. And this was one pivotal moment where I remembered, today I'm one of the lucky ones, because right now there's nothing going on with my baby's heart. And I'll never forget it, and I was so grateful. I just remember looking up and putting my hand on my heart and being so grateful that today my baby's heart was okay. Living through this life with babies with high complex needs is extremely overwhelming. And I don't think it matters how long the time goes on, because her life is now 4. It doesn't matter how long the time goes on, that it can still tear your own heart apart. And one of the biggest things I've learned through this is it doesn't just affect that child, it affects the entire family. So that stay, I think we were in there for 2 months, because I honestly couldn't figure out what was going on with him. And I remember at the end of it, we were a final family meeting thinking that we're about to go home just because he was somewhat stable. He finally stopped desaturating. His oxygen levels seemed to be okay. And at the end of this stay, there was a new lady there. And I was like, oh, who's she? And they introduced her, and her name was Penny Island. And she's an achondroplasia specialist. And I'd actually been searching for Penny. So Penny with achondroplasia, which is the dwarfism sign of what Hawaiki has. And I had reached out to a woman very early on when Hawaiki was in special care, because a nurse had told me about, yes, go and follow this lady. She has a boy who has achondroplasia, the dwarfism. You just might get some tips and advice. And so I reached out to her. I followed her. And her name's Jane Morley, and she's so gorgeous. And she just gave me all this information, and she said, you need to find Penny Island. So when Penny appeared in this meeting, I was just so ecstatic, because I had asked so many of the pediatricians, do you know where Penny Island is? Like, because I knew that she worked in that hospital, but no one could tell me. And I guess that goes to show that the hospital is just so big and so many people working there that no one has any idea about anyone else that works there. And believe me, I know that's true with having to deal with different situations. And when you're talking to, you know, one specialist about a different situation, they have no idea about the other field that you may be talking about. So it's very, very true. But what she had said, though, is it was amazing to meet her and just, you know, have her there with the achon side, which is completely different to the brain damage and the other diagnosis that he has, which is cerebral palsy now. So meeting her was fantastic, but I was so excited thinking, I'm going home. We're finally going home. We can go home. We'd been there for 8 weeks, like with Vera having to, you know, and my husband staying at the Ronald McDonald House every weekend to just try and be there with their family for us to be together. And she said to me, I'm really sorry, you can't go home today. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? And she said, I do believe your child, because it has achondroplasia. So Hawaiki we'd sent off genetic testing for this just a few weeks earlier, but the genetic testing takes a while to come back. And she said, you need to go for a sleep study. We need to see how he's sleeping. And because he has stopped breathing so many times, I guess she has her reasoning why that we need to go for this sleep study. And so we went for that sleep study. And then it came back that he was having many, many, many sleep apneas. And at this stage, I think it was about 180 to 200 overnight of him stopping breathing. And that were both central, which is to do with the brain neurological side, and obstructive, which is to do with his airway side, so the physical component of his structure. And then we had to wait another day because she said, you can go home, but we need to get oxygen delivered to you, and you need to have oxygen training before you leave. So that was another smack, and we were just like, oh my God. So our child was now on oxygen 24/7. So we had to go through all the settings of how oxygen was going to be placed in our home, how we have to go out with the oxygen. It could never leave his side. And this was a big thing, I guess, because at this stage, Hawaiki was, not that we'd been home much in the first few months of his life, but he was in a bassinet next to our bed. But with having Vera, and at this stage, so she's only 3 years old, and knowing that, so we had a massive oxygen tank, and it's attached to him via nasal prongs. And with her coming in, running in the middle of the night, like we couldn't have Hawaiki in our room anymore. So from that moment on, he was put into his own room and was by himself. But it was the safest way that we could set up our household with having a baby on oxygen. So we not only got that, he was having up to 200 apneas a night. They were both neurological and structural. And then obviously the possibility of achondroplasia, which we were pretty sure he had it because of his physical appearance and not having a bridge in his nose, and he has starfish hands, and they're all dominant aspects of having achondroplasia. But that this also had to be on him 24/7. So our care for him, which was already at maximum capacity, had to be lifted even higher. So that was a huge day with so many testings that went on and on and on and on. In the moment that, whilst I was also forever grateful for, I felt so sad for another mum with the heart condition that their baby had and how they had to be monitored. And I hadn't actually met that mum. I remember just thinking back, I hadn't actually introduced myself before that, because you feel like you're in, even though you see them all the time, you're in this cocoon to just look after your own baby, and you've got so much going on. But after that, I went and introduced myself, and I just said, I'm just here for you if you ever want to talk. And I think that it's easier for you to talk to other parents who have a medically complex child when that's something you're going through. So I found that somewhat easier for me to be able to talk about it with people that had maybe a little understanding. Whilst our situations were completely different, you know that we're going to understand a little bit of it. So I'm going to wrap this episode up with that, and that was one of our big stays. It was about 2 months. And, you know, like I said, one of the biggest things we've learned is it doesn't just affect the baby. It affects your whole family. And it will change your entire perspective of life for your entire family if you go through something with a child who has special needs. So thank you for listening. Keep your ears and eyes open, and I will check in with you soon, and we will have another episode coming shortly. See you guys. Have a lovely day.